Well, good evening, everyone. Nice to see you. It's my pleasure to share some thoughts about Verdi's Requiem and the history behind this remarkable piece. The genesis of Verdi's Requiem begins with the death of Gioachino Rossini on November 13th, 1868. Rossini, of course, was a great composer of 39 operas, the most famous being The Barber of Seville. He was revered in Italy. After the premiere of William Tell in 1829, Rossini stopped composing opera. At this time, he was the most famous composer alive. One writer had said some 5 years earlier, "During the last 12 years, there is no man who has been more frequently the subject of conversation from Moscow to Naples, from London to Vienna, from Paris to Calcutta, than Rossini. His glory already knows no other bounds than those of civilization itself, and yet he is barely 32. So this is Rossini as a younger man. This is Rossini as an older man. Music scholars do not believe he was on a strict exercise regimen. There's a story about Rossini being a bit on the lazy side, that he would sometimes compose in bed, and if the manuscript fell off, he would just write it again. He composed numerous songs and chamber pieces after his opera career under the title Sins of My Old Age. And mostly, he became known as a gourmand. He even got a steak named after him in Paris, the Torneros Rossini. So, 9 days after the death of Rossini, a letter from Giuseppe Verdi appeared in leading Italian papers, which proposed a requiem for Rossini, composed by all the prominent Italian composers of the day. This is what Verdi said. "To honor the memory of Rossini, I would wish the most distinguished Italian composers, Mercadante at the head, if only for a few bars, to compose a requiem mass to be performed on the anniversary of his death. I would like not only the composers, but all the performing artists, in addition to lending their services, to offer also a contribution to pay the expenses. I would like no foreign hand, no hand alien to art, no matter how powerful, to lend his assistance. In this case, I would withdraw at once from the association. The mass should be performed in San Petronio, in the city of Bologna, which was Rossini's true musical home." There's somebody you might not recognize, but that's actually yours truly in front of San Petronio. And it's probably too dark. Yeah, it's too dark for you to see that the bottom half of this huge church is made out of beautiful pink marble. And then after a point, it's all red brick from the way up. It's a budget cut, frozen in time. It's a remarkable building that comes from 1390. Well, anyhow, this is where Rossini spent much of his life. And no surprise, it's in the middle of Emilia-Romagna, which is known to have the best food in Italy. So Verdi's proposal of a requiem was interesting for several reasons, including that he was known to be anti-clerical and certainly, like Brahms in Britain, agnostic. Indeed, a committee was formed in June of 1869, and it chose which texts from the Latin Mass for the Dead would be used, and the key structure for the composition to limit possible harmonic chaos. And about the committee's choices, Verdi said, "It seems to me it was done with the greatest judgment in regards to the division, form, and distribution of the pieces." In August of 1869, Verdi asked Tito Ricordi, his publisher, to send him blank music paper. On August 20th, he announced that his movement was done, adding to his publisher, "In case this ceremony does not take place, I urge you to see that this piece is well taken care of and returned to me." Verdi had good reason to be cautious about the prospects of an ultimate performance. 12 composers besides Verdi were selected, mostly church composers, such luminaries as Antonio Buzzolo Gaetano Gaspari, and Pietro Platania. You ever heard of these folks? No. All right. Well, the committee assigned the final portion, the Liberame, to Verdi. The music was written, lasting over 2 hours, the total piece. Here's the next part of the Messa per Rossini. So, the interesting thing is that in true Italian fashion, the problems about organization, funding, the commitment of the musicians doomed the plans. And the Mass per Rossini was not ever performed until finally Helmut Rilling organized a performance and a recording in 1988. That was the first time it was ever done. And I apologize if I'm blocking the view of some of you. It's bad planning on my part. So, sure enough, Verdi's manuscript was returned to him in April of 1873. And here are just a few of those composers. Pazzini, Padrotti, Ricci, Nini, Carlo Coccia. Well, mostly forgotten today, of course. There is some evidence that Verdi had already decided to complete his own Requiem around this time, but it was the death of Alessandro Manzoni in May of 1873, and very possibly Verdi's anticipation of this death that brought about the completion of the Requiem that you'll hear tonight. Now, Alessandro Manzoni was one of the greatest authors and statesmen in Italian history. Almost anywhere you go in Italy, you see a statue of Manzoni in a square. On his death, Verdi wrote, "Now all is over, and with him ends the greatest of our glories." Verdi met Manzoni in 1848. He described the experience as being in the presence of a saint. As a youth, Verdi had adored Manzoni's I Promessi Sposi, which he described as the greatest book to ever emerge from a human brain. The novel was also a symbol of the Italian Risorgimento movement, which Verdi himself has identified, the movement to unite the Italian peninsula from a group of city-states into one country. In fact, Verdi's name itself stood as an emblem for this movement. Viva Verdi, Vittorio Emanuele Re d'Italia. And people used it as a slogan to show their support of Italian unification. This is a drawing you probably can't see tonight of Manzoni's funeral procession. Verdi's preferred title, the one we say Verdi's Requiem, but what we should be saying is the Messa di Requiem per l'anniversario della morte Manzoni, 20 maggio 1874. That's what we should be saying. Following Manzoni's death, Verdi sent the following message to his publisher. "I am profoundly saddened by the death of our great master, but I shall not come to Milan, for I would not have the heart to attend his funeral. I will come soon to visit his grave, alone and unseen, and perhaps, after further reflection, having weighed my strength, to propose something to honor his memory." Well, Verdi had learned his lesson with the Rossini Requiem and relied on no one else other than himself this time around. After guaranteeing the performance circumstances with the city of Milan, Verdi went about composing the rest of the Requiem. There are dozens of differences between the early version of the Liberame and the final version, but here are just a few really noticeable ones. So here is the Dies Irae that we're familiar with, that you'll be hearing tonight. So, that's what we're used to hearing. Here's the original music that Verdi composed from 1869. So you notice there are none of those famous bass drum offbeats there. It's completely different in the way he's using the solo soprano. So here is also from the lead. Following, you know, there's this beautiful a cappella section to the text, Requiem Aeternam, in the Liber Me. And in the final version, the music's in B-flat minor. In the original, and the soprano must ascend to a high B-flat. It's one of the most challenging passages for any solo soprano to do it softly. Well, in the original version, the music was in A minor, so the soprano only has to go to an A. Easy, right? So here's a little bit more that follows that passage. Listen to the differences. So, really different. The soprano comes in with an undulation of an open fifth. Well, I did a really careful study of Verdi's original music and then his subsequent version, and almost in every step, he's making it more dramatic and more practical. The second version, of course, the strings don't play open fifth, they play a tritone, much more dramatic. Let's see. And then we're off into this fantastic fugue on the Liber Me. And in the original version, Verdi closes the movement with a chant, the same chant that we hear the chorus do early on. And in the version that we hear today, the soprano does it on a low C. Liber Me, Domine de morte eternam, die illa tremenda. But in the first version, he had the chorus basses. He probably realized that it would be a bit on the muddy side if he did it with the basses instead of the solo soprano. Like Rossini, later in life, Verdi viewed himself as being done with opera. He spent a lot of time studying Bach's Mass in B minor. And Verdi also modeled Rossini's turn to sacred music by doing the same thing. And of course, fortunately for the musical world, Verdi still had some of his greatest opera to come in Falstaff and Othello. In order to have the Requiem premiered, Verdi had to seek permission from the Archbishop of Milan to allow women to sing in performance at San Marco. And the one stipulation was, once this dispensation was given, was that the women had to be veiled as they sang. That would have an interesting dynamic effect, I believe. And I wouldn't, you know, of course I wouldn't be able to tell if you were looking up or not, so certain advantages. There was a great deal of tension at this time between church and state. In February of 1874, the Milan Council met to discuss the proposal. Verdi's friend and ultimate librettist, Arrigo Boito, was on the city council. The completed Requiem was finally premiered on May 22, 1874 in Milan, the anniversary of Manzoni's death. Verdi ultimately received the dispensations he needed. I don't know, you probably can't see clearly this drawing of the first performance, but it's very instructive to learn about the singers that Verdi involved in the first performance. One of the most interesting was the soprano, Maria Stolz. Her voice was described by Verdi as following. Madame Stolz's voice is a pure soprano, with immense compass and the most perfectly beautiful quality one ever listened to, from the lowest note to the highest. The tones are as fine and clearly cut as diamonds and sweet as a silver bell, but the power she gives a high C is something amazing. Wouldn't you love to hear that voice? Well, you will tonight with Sarah Garfield. And about the mezzo-soprano, also of Germanic descent, Maria Waldman, He said, Maria Waldman can do all the high A's and B's she wants, but she will always be a contralto. Interestingly. And then a little less description about the tenor and the bass. It's reported that Verdi's principal criterion for the tenor was that he have an attractive vocal quality more important than any intelligence, musical artistry, or acting abilities. His ideal was Giuseppe Fanculli, renowned for his beautiful voice and monumental stupidity. Verdi once characterized him as, and I quote, a beautiful voice, but a pumpkin head. So you recall that Verdi wanted the Rossini Requiem to be stored in an archive and removed just for the special occasion, like the anniversary of Rossini's death. For his own Requiem, Verdi was much more practical and showed obvious concern with promulgating the piece. Again, you probably can't see this first edition of the title page. Today's orchestra is, of course, very different from the one that Verdi knew. We use a tuba, but Verdi's orchestra would have used the cimbasso. And the piece really took off. It became very popular. Verdi conducted the piece ultimately in many European capitals, including some very large performances. 3 years after the premiere, he conducted a chorus of 500 and an orchestra of 200 at the Lower Rhine Music Festival in Cologne. That's a pretty good ratio of singers to players, I think. He also conducted a choir of 1,200 with 120 in the orchestra. An excellent ratio, if you ask me. But it's a huge challenge in this piece with modern instruments to make everything balance. Not all of the receptions were positive. Hans von Bülow, the great German conductor, famously spoke ill of the piece after briefly seeing the score, saying, Verdi's latest opera in ecclesiastical garb, the all-powerful corrupter of Italian artistic taste, presumably hopes to sweep away the remains of Rossini's immortality, which is so troubling to his own ambition. Not only did he enrage the Italian press with these comments, but his German countryman, Johannes Brahms, said, Von Bülow made a fool of himself for all time. Only a genius could write such a work. I love that. When you consider the nature of Johannes Brahms, his classicism, his reserve, and yet he could see in this very different style the obvious genius of Verdi. Some other interesting things about Verdi. We, of course, today sing at a certain pitch, A equals 440 hertz. And pitch was not yet standardized in the 19th century, but they were having a conference in the 1870s to try to standardize it. And Verdi sent word that his preferred pitch was A equals 432, which is not quite a half step lower than what we sing at. But again, interesting, because it would have made all the voices that much warmer and all the music had a slightly less tension. So, while many have commented on the operatic nature of this music, it is good to remember that Verdi was simply writing in the style of the time. And yet, Verdi makes use of many traditional aspects of church music. Here's the structure of the piece. It opens with an introitus and Kyrie that includes a beautiful a cappella section on the words Te Decet Hymnus. And the next part is the longest part of the Requiem, the Dies Irae. The Dies Irae, of course, is a chant, ancient church poem in a rhyming text. Dies Irae, Dies Ila, Sovet Seclum Infabila, Teste David Cum Sabila. Of course, the chant is Dies Irae, Dies Ila, Sovet Seclum Infabila, Teste David Cum Sibila. Everything rhymes. He doesn't make use of that chant, only chant like elements. You see the parts of the Dies Irae, and then we will take an intermission tonight, since the chorus has to stand the entire time. I will let them have a break, as well as you. Then when we come back, we have the offertory, which has two parts in it, the Domine and Hostias, just for the four solo voices, and a significant solo for the cellos, followed by the Sanctus, which is an eight-part fugue, reminiscent of Verdi's writing in the finales of Falstaff, amazing counterpoint, followed by the simple and prayerful Agnus Dei for the two female soloists, choir. That is followed by, I left off something important, the movement Lux Aeterna, the sixth movement, which is just for the mezzo-soprano, tenor, and bass soloists. That's important because it is only the soprano soloist who is used in the Liberame, the final movement. So Verdi gave the soprano a rest by using the other three soloists. When you hear this sixth movement, be sure to listen for the amazing orchestration. I personally do not feel Verdi gets enough credit for his brilliant orchestration. He understood the orchestra so well, particularly his use of winds and string harmonics and tremolando. Really wonderful. And then the final movement, the one I spoke about earlier, the Liberame. There are a number of elements of older church music, like this a cappella polyphonic section, the Te Decet Hymnos. Let's listen to just a little of that. It's one of two a cappella passages in the Requiem, but very much harkens back to older music. And then, of course, we have this amazing fugue in the last movement. Going back to the fourth movement, it seems to me like people who take the time to come to a pre-concert talk should know at least something that the rest of the audience doesn't know. So I'll just let you in on how we structure the chorus for a performance like this. The Sanctus calls for a double chorus. So we will have chorus one on this side, to my left, chorus two to my right. But within those choruses, the parts are somewhat mixed, so the singers can hear each other very well. The Sanctus is particularly quick. The movement lasts only about 2.5 minutes, but wow, is it a great 2.5 minutes. That's not part of it. Hold on. It's incredibly intricate, the interplay of these eight voices, and Verdi's mastery of the counterpoint is amazing. I would be happy to answer any questions you might have in a moment as I approach the conclusion of my remarks here. One of the things that I find most moving about this piece is the depth of emotion that Verdi achieves. There are few pieces like it. It's exhausting to perform and conduct, because by the time you've done the whole piece, if it's a good performance, you've given everything you have. And that is true for everyone on the stage. And I've had the privilege of doing it many times, but it is a piece that is a privilege every time to do. I should also mention, since we're in this glorious space, and we're very grateful to be in this glorious space, that Verdi anticipated the full use of the room as an instrument. When we arrive at the words for the last trumpet, the Tuba Mirum, and the day of judgment is at hand, we all know that when that day comes, you're not going to hear an oboe, you're not going to hear an English horn, you're going to hear a trumpet, right? Unless you're German, and then you'll hear a trombone. I'm just kidding. The Germans call it the Der letzte Posaune, which is the word for trombone. But that's okay. They're a little different. But to achieve this effect, Verdi utilizes 8 trumpets, 4 in the orchestra, and 4 that are to be spread around the room. And although there are more grandiose attempts at this, the Berlioz Requiem would be the case in point, where Berlioz goes a step better by not just using 4 offstage trumpets, but 4 separate brass choirs. Nobody matches what Verdi achieves in this Dies Irae. It is spine-tingling. It is thrilling. I won't give away where these voices, these supernal trumpet voices, will emanate from. But I will say that we will definitely be making use of this glorious space to try to achieve the effect that Verdi is looking for. So, I would be delighted to answer any questions that you might have, if you have some. Don't let me down. I'm sure somebody has something. Yes, sir. Okay, this is a very good question. Will tonight's performance look a lot like the first performance would have? Well, they had an interesting tradition from the 18th century through the 19th century, and that was that they would often put the chorus in front of the orchestra. And one of the reasons that they would do that was to make you overcame all the balance problems. Because it's not a fair fight between instruments and human voices unless you get a lot of voices together. So this is an interesting space for us to perform in because it is not a concert hall. And so we have made many adjustments from what you would call traditional placement. And the orchestra is arranged in a non-traditional way in order to make things work. The chorus is also arranged in a horseshoe. And you should find out, if you're a friend of one of the chorus members, you should find out where they are so that you're not disappointed because of these massive pillars. We looked into having them removed, and it's something to do with the building staying up. So some of them are behind the pillars. But our solution is not far away from the drawing of the first performance. It's fairly close. That was a very good question. Others? Yes. There is only one recording of the original version that I know about, and that is that 1988 recording by Helmut Rilling, when they got together and performed and recorded the Mass for Rossini. And who knows, that could be the only performance in history. But it is available. You could go on Amazon and get that recording. It's very interesting. Yes. Terrific. Is there one more question? All right. Well, thank you so much for being here tonight. And we really hope you enjoy and are moved by tonight's performance. Thank you.